I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. When we opened the lines a few months ago, we got a call from Amy, who asked us to do a show about caregiving for partners. Amy has been caring for her partner of 45 years, who is experiencing advanced cognitive decline and other serious medical conditions. She said, while the caregiving crisis in this country is getting more attention than ever, the focus is usually on caring for parents, not partners. And then we ran across a new book by today's guest, Laura Malden, called In Sickness and in Health, Love Stories from the Front Lines of America's Caregiving Crisis. We are so happy to have Laura here today, and our caller Amy will be joining us in the second half of the show. When Laura Malden was just 27, she moved to New York to attend graduate school and fell in love with a woman named Jay. Just a few months into their relationship, Jay sat Laura down to tell her that her leukemia had returned, and that turned Laura from a romantic partner into an unpaid full-time caregiver. As Laura fought to keep Jay alive, she experienced what so many caregivers do, a system designed to let both those in need of care and their caregivers fall through the cracks. In her new book, In Sickness and in Health, Laura Malden, who is now a sociologist and disability studies professor, unpacks these experiences and interweaves them with the stories of couples from across the country navigating the immense challenges of chronic illness and disease. She argues that we must reimagine our care systems so none of the estimated 53 million family caregivers in the United States, or 6 in 10 U.S. adults who have a chronic condition, that's 29% of the adult population who are categorized as disabled, are left to do it all alone. Laura Malden writes, "At the heart of this book is my belief that we must talk openly about the private pain we carry when it comes to caregiving, whether we are giving care, receiving care, or both. We are all coping with impossible demands, with grief and loss, and with the loneliness of being discarded by a culture that devalues caregiving because it devalues the people who need it. Staying silent only furthers our alienation because it completes the cycle of state and societal abandonment in the cruelest of ways. It makes us think that we must face our most human experiences alone. But we are not alone. If you are the one, you are one of millions. If you are disabled or chronically ill, you are one of millions. If anything is to change, we must listen to one another's stories, learn how to better love ourselves and each other, and build a different future of more collective care." Laura Malden is associate professor in the Department of Social and Critical Inquiry at the University of Connecticut and a nationally certified sign language interpreter. She runs the website Disability at Home, which highlights the ingenuity of disabled people and caregivers sharing advice on how to make homes accessible. Her new book is In Sickness and in Health, Love Stories from the Front Lines of America's Caregiving Crisis. Hi, Laura. Thank you so much for this really beautiful and important book, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, I'm so happy to have you. This is such a personal story for so many of us. And I've talked about my experience of taking care of my parents for about the last 10 or so years for various reasons. And I sadly lost my dad to a rare and aggressive form of cancer last January. And so we do a lot of shows about caregiving. And I think what's so interesting, Laura, is I am from the generation where a lot of the parents of my friends got divorced, including my parents. And so I had parents who were, for the most part, on their own. And I thought, well, why don't we talk about this anymore? Because if you have parents who are still together and you're lucky, they might be able to take care of each other. But if you have parents who are divorced, it's all on you. And so I think that deserves more attention. And then I was so struck when Amy called us a couple months ago and said, I'm so glad the caregiving crisis is getting more attention than ever, but it's often focused on parents, not partners. And then the timing was kind of amazing because we ran across your book. So what are your thoughts, given your experience, that this issue is getting more attention than ever, but it tends to focus on parents, not partners?
Sure. And first of all, Rose, I'm sorry for your loss, and I'm glad that you're talking about these things.
Thank you.
I do think that the majority of the time that we're talking about the caregiving crisis, it is typically about aging parents. There's a reason for that we have this sort of baby boomer generation that's just really large. So it's about numbers. And then when you look at the breakdown of different categories of family caregivers, those caring for their aging parents are the largest percentage of that broader picture. And in fact, earlier when I wrote the book, which just came out, the number was 53 million family caregivers in the US. But since the book has come out, there's been an update, a new release of numbers. It is now 63 million. So it
Wow.
just keeps going up. And it is true, again, that the largest portion of that are adults caring for their aging parents. And partners get less attention, partly because they make up only something like 13% or so of family caregivers. So I think sometimes they get forgotten because they're a smaller percentage. And I also think they get forgotten precisely because they are spousal or partner caregivers, because we expect spouses or partners to do that work. It doesn't seem like this particularly interesting burden, if you will, because these folks have, quote unquote, taken a vow, and that's their job. And there's this expectation culturally that that's just what you do. So I think we also gloss over it for that reason. And I'll just add one more thing about spousal caregivers in particular, which is that all the research shows that they are often caregiving for the longest periods of time, sometimes decades, as you've mentioned, and I think your caller Amy mentioned. They also do more intensive caregiving, what's categorized as intensive, meaning probably more medically sophisticated, might involve more things like wound care or infusions, things that are much more medically sophisticated. And then they often have the higher rates of stress and burnout, precisely because the other big feature of spousal caregivers is that they're more likely than anyone else to be alone doing it without help.
Wow. And then there's the emotional aspect of it. You're caring for your loved one.
Yeah, the person that was who you would go to talk about everything with, the person who you are romantically in love with. And how do you square this new role that you have with that can be very difficult.
You write about this, the beautiful love story and meeting your partner Jay when you were in your 20s. And Jay had leukemia. When you were just 27 years old, you became her caregiver. Why did you decide to write about that personal story and turn it into a book?
Well, I can tell you it's been 20 years, and I'm still struggling to make sense of what happened. And I figured that if I was trying to make sense of it, and I wasn't alone in that experience, I think other people were trying to make sense of it too. And really, the goal of this book is to put myself out there and to let others know that they're not alone. That's really the goal. And it just so happened that I was also training at the time that I met Jay in sociology and disability studies. And so there was also this sort of theoretical or academic understanding that I brought to it. And I think I naively thought that that would translate into being able to emotionally or psychologically understand and make sense of what was happening. And so, again, I thought, if I, even with all of these sort of academic tools, am having trouble making sense of this experience and recovering from it, then I'm certain that other people are too and would need to hear this story.
And given that you interviewed so many couples and you really relived the experience of caregiving for Jay, which is so intense, what was it like to be doing this research and then to watch the media coverage? Because I think for the first time ever, caregiving is really having a moment. There's so many stories out there, documentaries, reports. We're finally talking about caregiving. What are your thoughts about that? And what do you think is still missing from the conversation?
Yes, I agree that we are talking more about caregiving. And it's wonderful to see those conversations happen. What I often think is missing, and I noticed this from being part of, so I was also, you mentioned in the bio up front, the top of the show, that I'm also a sign language interpreter. And so I've been in deaf and disability communities my whole life of different kinds across different cities and states and the world, really. And what I noticed is that I became a caregiver and I would go to my caregiving support groups, and yet no one was really talking about why our caregiving responsibilities were so enormous and why we were so alone in what we were doing. And one of the things I try to talk about in the book is that the burden isn't caring for someone. The burden is not disabled or chronically ill people. The burden is that we have been abandoned by the state, by our society, to do it by ourselves without infrastructure, without adequate systems to assist us and help with the material realities and needs that that day-to-day caregiving requires. So one of the things I noticed was this caregiving conversation starts happening. I'm in community with other caregivers. We are all talking about these things. Caregiving has this moment culturally, but what's missing to me is an understanding of why caregivers have been abandoned in this way. And we know that, I think it's the numbers right now are something like 75% of family caregivers are women. So we know that this is sort of devalued domestic work. That is a, I think, well-known explanation for why we don't support caregivers. But I think there's another explanation that will help us round this out, which is that we devalue caregiving and we don't talk about it and we abandon caregivers to do that work because we devalue the people who need care. Because we do not think that disabled people and chronically ill people are worth investing in. We don't build systems and infrastructure for their care, and this affects all of us. So there is a connection between the politics of disability and the politics of caregiving. And so I often don't see that connection being made. When I'm in these disability communities, the politics of disability and the idea of something called ableism, which a lot of people may not have heard of, and I've gotten feedback on the book of people reading it and saying, oh, I'd never heard of ableism. I didn't know that was a thing. And if it's helpful, I just sort of very simply define it as the devaluation of certain bodies and people who aren't seen as quote unquote productive for the economy or independent, right? So it's simply that we value certain types of bodies and what they can do, and we reward those bodies that we value with, you know, if you work, you get healthcare. Right? So we can make these connections about who we think deserves care. And that's typically able-bodied productive folks and people who are disabled or chronically ill because of ableism, that cultural belief that they're less than, that they're not worth our resources, that are that translates into policies, regulations, all of our choices about care infrastructure in this country. And we have to understand that.
This is such an important point, because when you think about, it's mostly people on the right who now say you can only get food assistance if you work. If you're not working, you're not worthy, period.
Correct.
And they don't look at what is a person dealing with? Do they have a disability? Are they older? Has their body given out on them for a variety of reasons? And it was so striking to read about that you have so many amazing stats and information about people with disabilities in your book. Nearly 29% of the adult population are categorized as disabled and left to do it alone. And it got me thinking about my parents who deal with chronic pain and they have a disability, but I never really thought about them as having a disability. So I think it's so interesting the way we think of someone with a disability. What does that mean exactly?
Yes, I love that you brought that up because I am a person who uses it very loosely. I kind of use it as this universal category, as a social category. In other words, I'm not really interested in, did this person acquire an impairment because they aged into it? Would we consider this a typical part of the aging process? Or does this person have a chronic illness and does that, you know, count per se as a disability? How are we measuring this? I wasn't really very concerned with that. What I was more concerned about was thinking of everyone who has a body that needs care that we might consider an abnormal level of care, right? A more than expected level of care, because there are certain things that we expect people to need, and that's considered quote unquote normal. But anyone who has an impairment, again, whatever kind of impairment it is, whether it's aged into or not, I was thinking of all of these people within a social or political category of disability because fundamentally their bodies are devalued and they have to deal with the same systems. So whether you're aging into impairment versus you are disabled as a young person, you might both qualify for Medicare because Medicare does cover some people who are younger than 65 who meet specific definitions. So that's just one example of a system. Like there's a shared set of systems that all of these folks have to work within and are cut out of in a lot of ways. So I feel like using disability more universally is socially or politically helpful because it helps us know that we're not alone, that you're aging into an impairment, but actually that is an experience that is political and you're part of a larger political group. And if you understand yourself as part of a larger group, there's something that we can do about it together if we can cross these categorical lines.
Today, we are speaking with Laura Malden, Associate Professor in the Department of Social and Critical Inquiry at the University of Connecticut and a nationally certified sign language interpreter. Laura Malden runs the website Disability at Home, which highlights the ingenuity of disabled people and caregivers sharing advice on how to make homes accessible. Her new book is In Sickness and in Health, Love Stories from the Front Lines of America's Caregiving Crisis. Laura writes about her own experience after she moved to New York to attend graduate school and fell in love with a woman named Jay. Just a few months into their relationship, Jay sat Laura down to tell her that her leukemia had returned, and that turned Laura from a romantic partner into an unpaid full-time caregiver. If you have a partner that you are taking care of and you'd like to share your story, we would love to hear from you. And now that caregiving is getting a lot more attention, are you now planning for this? Because we're living longer for various reasons, not necessarily healthier. Our people have chronic diseases, cancers at very young age. So many things happen, strokes. There's just such a long list. So are you planning for this? How are you thinking about this at a time when it is very, very difficult to get basic help with healthcare and to maybe bring people in to help if you need a break? Laura is arguing that we have to reframe the conversation so we do not do this alone. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. You know, talking about resources, you introduce one of your chapters with a very just straightforward quote by disability rights activist Alice Wong, who tragically died in November. She said, "The safety net is not a net. It's a big effing hole." And I think this is so important because it is hard for people to just get basic assistance, especially when they're sick. You write a lot, and we'll get into this, about, you know, a couple who had a hard time getting basic health care. You write about SSDI. So just generally, can you talk about how the safety net has really come undone over the years? And we'll talk about what is happening under Trump.
Sure. Yes, it's been very distressing to see what's happening right now. But we have a long history in this country of not wanting to provide universal care to people. And so what happens is we've devised these systems that are basically piecemeal. So you have the system like Medicare that is for those 65 and older, a system like Medicaid, which is for those who meet very specific criteria around poverty levels. And there are other systems as well, but all of these are piecemeal. And you have to, they're means tested, so you have to qualify for them. And that requires paperwork and many steps and levels of approval and all of these things. And one of the things that I try to argue is that these are really good examples of the ways that ableism has basically infiltrated and like permeates every single system we have, because part of ableism is disbelief or a suspicion that someone is quote unquote faking it. And so there's all of these measures in place to sort of make it as difficult as possible to qualify for things. And that translates into devastating losses for people because they may not be able to pay their rent in the meantime. They may become homeless. They may, in fact, we know that thousands of people die every year waiting for SSDI approval. So these systems are, I think, if you've had to deal with them, you know that they can be experienced as rather hostile. And it seems that we're being asked each, you know, it feels like each year to do more with less and have these systems chronically underfunded again and again and again. And of course, the one big beautiful bill that was passed last year has actually just utterly decimated Medicaid in so many ways that will affect those who are getting home and community-based services across the country.
Exactly. And to be specific about this, you write about it in your book. It includes $1 trillion in cuts to Medicaid, the only federal program that provides long-term home care, and the Children's Health Insurance Program, which will cause over 10 million people to lose their insurance. They have reported plans to make the largest cuts to Social Security disability insurance in history. They eliminated the Administration for Community Living, which provides funding for centers for independent living, meal programs, and caregiver assistance for disabled and older adults. And Laura, I mean, this is not surprising, but across the board, these programs are popular. People do not want cuts to these programs.
Correct. And I think that a lot of times we look at these numbers and think, you know, what is all of that money going to? But if you are a person who is relying on these services, you know that it is not actually even enough as it already, like before these cuts went through last year, it was already not enough. Some of the data show that most people who receive SSDI do not receive a living wage. I mean, in the sense that what they get each month and SSDI does not actually pay for very much at all. It's not a robust system to start with. And so this is a really big problem. But again, I think a lot of our attitudes, we know that there's a lot of assumption that there must be, quote, waste, fraud, and abuse. This comes up a lot in political discussions. But again, the data bear out that less than 1% of SSDI monies have anything to do with fraud. Mm. So I think these are cultural beliefs. and assumptions about disability that are driving this.
So how do we take that on? I mean, one issue is we just need to have more people with disabilities in the media with a wide range of disabilities, because so many people have disabilities that no one knows about, and people don't, yes. In many cases, they don't want to talk about it.
And that, I think, not being able to talk about it and the idea of keeping these things super private and secret, I think there are many people out there that have a chronic condition or have a disability that may not be apparent, right? We may not be able to look at that person and see it. And so it sort of goes without being recognized. But it's also true that because of the stigma associated with disability, that most people who are disabled actually don't identify as such. Mm. So there's this kind of reluctance to say, yes, I am a part of this group. And I have a friend whose parents were aging into these impairments, and she said, oh, I'm so excited for your website to show them all of these hacks and tips to make their home more accessible. And I sent it to them, and they said, oh, we don't need that. We're not disabled. Hmm. We're just older. Hmm. We're just aging into these things. So there's this disconnect, I think, which then results in us not talking about it, which means it stays invisible. And so I really try to tell these stories so that we can make those connections that you're part of this group and we need to talk about it. And we need to talk about all of the difficult things that we might be actually ashamed of. But the more we talk about it, the better it can be.
Mm-hmm. That's such an important point. Today we're joined by Laura Malden. We're talking about her new book, In Sickness and in Health, Love Stories from the Front Lines of America's Caregiving Crisis. There are now 63 million caregivers in this country. Laura writes about her own experience 20 years ago when she moved to New York and fell in love with a woman named Jay, found out that her leukemia returned, and Laura turned into an unpaid full-time caregiver. She writes about that in her new book, and she also interviews other couples who are dealing with caregiving. And if you have a story to share, any thoughts about this, if you're caring for a partner, or if you're thinking about what's going to happen when you or your partner needs help, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And then, of course, tackling the bigger questions, what will it take to reimagine caregiving so we don't have to do this alone, so people don't have to worry about how they're going to pay for supplies or food, or how they're going to be able to even go to the doctor, because that's another crisis in this country. 866-798-8255. This is your call. We'll be back after this. Then we'll talk about a new CalMatters piece about the more than 20,000 immigrant truck drivers who will be able to keep their California licenses, at least for now, despite efforts by the Trump administration and the state of California to revoke them. And then next Tuesday, we are starting a brand new series about the United States at 250. You've probably heard Trump talk about and celebrate the doctrine of discovery, saying that the West was empty. And isn't it amazing that people built these new lands and these new cities? Well, we're going to do a series called The U.S. at 250, A Native Perspective. So we're going to have on a wide range of indigenous voices to talk about the true history of this country. We hope you can join us for that. That will be ongoing. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email your call at kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about the caregiving crisis in this country, if you are taking care of a partner, or if you have needed care from a partner, if you're thinking about these issues, what are your thoughts about the bigger picture, how we can change the system so people do not have to fall through the cracks? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Today we're joined by Laura Malden, Associate Professor in the Department of Social and Critical Inquiry at the University of Connecticut and a nationally certified sign language interpreter. She runs the website Disability at Home and is author of the brand new book, In Sickness and in Health, Love Stories from the Front Lines of America's Caregiving Crisis. And now we would like to welcome Amy, who called us when we opened the lines a couple of months ago to ask us to do a show about caregiving for partners, because most of the caregiving stories and shows are about parents. Amy is a full-time educator and a full-time caregiver to her partner of 45 years who has advanced cognitive decline and other serious medical conditions. Hi, Amy. Thank you so much again for calling in with the show idea, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so very much for having me. And especially how wonderful to get to meet Laura, and for you finding her book, which I just listened to on audio yesterday.
Oh, wow.
and last night, and that has actually is now one of the most important books in my life, up there with Yellow Raft and Blue Water. So just in terms of I felt as if I have new family. And I would have to say, I just want to recommend that anybody who's a caregiver, especially as partner caregivers, listen to this book, because I've listened to the ending, the public display of love. Please forgive me the title, but I think it's going to be my grounding and my own kind of serenity prayer. So thank you so much for that gift. I said to your producer yesterday, Rose, that I'm afraid of going on and on and on because there's so much to share, but I don't know how you want me to start or what you would like me to talk about.
Well, first I'd love to get Laura's response to what you just said about your chapter, Public Display of Affection. Amy now feels like has kind of a new family. What are your thoughts about that?
It's so meaningful to me when I get this kind of feedback from people who have read the book. And again, my goal with the book was to help people feel less alone. And so it makes me feel like I am meeting that goal. Mm-hmm. And it's so meaningful to me because I wanted to end the book with this offering to the people who I spent many years with interviewing and talking to and bothering about every fact and every tiny mm-hmm. detail. And I wanted to give back to those who are caregivers and those who are receiving care and express my affection for them and leave the book and end it with something that you can pick up anytime you need to feel comforted and feel worthwhile in a world that tells you that you're not worth anything. So,
yes.
And this is such a beautiful and important part of the book. If the state has abandoned us, then mm-hmm. we must not abandon each other. We must grow our own care collectives in the absence of publicly funded resources.
Mm-hmm.
And Amy, I'm just wondering, you've been a caretaker for your husband since 2019, you've been together for 45 mm-hmm. years. Is this something that you both talked about? What would happen if one of you needed care from the other?
And to add more nuance to that, my husband was actually finally diagnosed with severe dementia in 2019. Wow. After years and years, probably 6 to 8 years before that, of me telling the doctors that I was seeing the early signs, because my grandfather, who had dementia, lived with my husband and I after my grandmother died with dementia. And so I knew the early signs, because those of us who've been through this know the early signs of it. It's not something usually that's sudden. It's usually something that grows. And then in retrospect, looking back, so when you've been through it, you can see it. My husband's older than me. And I think part of why doctors were not accepting what I and even Lou was reporting to doctors and telling his therapist and talking to our best friends was, I think that there was some, what we kept being told was these are signs of normal aging. People forget things, this and that. And my experience was, how do you go from everything's fine, normal aging, to severe when we had regular appointments with the doctor because he was falling all the time. He had become incontinent. I mean, these are things that are not part of normal aging. So it was really hard. So no, I don't think there had been any kind of really talk about him caring for me if something were to happen. But we had talked about me caring for him, and we did not buy long-term insurance health care for him because I thought, oh, I'll take care of him. But I bought it for me because I do not have adult kids. He has adult kids who I think they, not being my biological kids, are express a lot of gratitude for me taking care of him, but are not really there. They visit sometimes and recently have agreed to when I really need, like when I need a whole day to take care of business, to once in a while take care of him. Yeah, so it's hard being alone. Yeah.
Well, and that's the other aspect of this, Laura, that deserves so much more attention, is in addition to caring for your partner, you have to become their biggest advocate, and you really have to learn how to navigate the system, which is really difficult to be heard or to figure out what steps to take next. That alone is a full-time job, Laura.
Absolutely. And one of the things I try to capture in this book is how varied the role becomes, because you have to be somebody who knows how to navigate insurance companies and all of their lingo, and to, you know, follow up on this bill or this overcharge. And then you've got to also know how to navigate between different departments in a hospital or clinics that aren't speaking to each other, but are both, you know, implicated in something for your partner. And then you've got to learn how to do medical things and medication management and, you know, bathing and dressing, and how do you transfer someone safely without throwing out your back? I mean, these are things that it just runs the gamut, but it's all so invisible that people don't know all of the various pieces there are to this and how daunting it is to try to master them all as one person.
Amy, what was it like for you to be put in that role, taking care of your husband, of your partner?
It's a lot of work. I'm trying to hold on to the me in our relationship also, and my own identity, and working is my touchstone to maintaining that identity. So doing that along with all the caregiving, there was a glitch in our medical insurance recently. And he did not have medical insurance, and it was a glitch, and it was a catch-22 trying to get it back enrolled and blah, blah, blah. So it was like, but it was scary because we were putting off doctor's appointments, and I was scared, and I was scared for myself because I lost mine also. It was, again, just a glitch, and I was having chest pains. I have an aunt who's also a caregiver to her partner, who has Parkinson's, advanced Parkinson's. She ended up in the hospital with a heart attack due to the, and this is something else that happens, a lot of us end up with our own health problems because of the stress of the caregiving, and often not tending to it because we are so caught up in the caregiving. But there's that, but it's 24/7. I feel like I'm not fully answering your question.
You definitely are. Can you talk more a little about what it is like to take care of a spouse? And I mean, extreme dementia is so difficult.
Is, It is. So there's, I'm up many times a night. There's recently been a just barely started at the North Berkeley Senior Center, a once a month, 1 hour. It's kind of like coaching for taking care of somebody with dementia. But as little as some of us stick around and talk afterwards. But it's so very common that people don't realize is loss of a sense of time. So sleeping for short bits throughout the day and the night, which means getting up many times a night. So when I'm asleep, I'm really only ever, I always have one ear open. I would like, there's a similarity, and I want to make this parallel on purpose to having a very young baby. And what parents talk about, there's the sleep deprivation, there's the always on, there's the needing to know what they're doing all the time, there's you cannot leave them alone. And one of the differences, and I think I said this when I called a few months ago, Rose, is that when people have a baby, you can talk about it openly. Everybody, it's kind of like, oh, that's so wonderful. And people want to come in and offer help and come hang out with you. And when it's somebody with dementia, or somebody who has a big illness, and I think you talk about that also in your book, Laura, so many of the people that you interviewed, people fall away. And it's really interesting to see who stays in your life as support and who you thought would always be there kind of fades away, or who only wants to see the person at big family gatherings, which are really hard for the people anyway. So it's hard. It's emotionally, it can be hard because it's hard being alone with it and sometimes feeling not seen. It's also a societal thing in terms of imagine a society without childcare. Imagine a society where we expected just one parent to take care of. To be 100% responsible for a child.
Right.
That's what it's like. And yeah, there's a part of me that would, I'm trying to get up the courage. I wrote this down because I want to say this out loud as a commitment to myself. I'm trying to get up the courage to reach out to people who have fallen away and say, if you're thinking that someday you will come to a life celebration for Lou in honor of who he was as a father, a grandfather, a teacher, a director. He was the head of the theater department at Laney College. He did political theater for years and years. He was
Wow.
a mentor to so many people. If you want to come to the life celebration, how about instead come visit with him now? Some people are, and it is so beautiful. Also, visits are like a health elixir for him. They really are. I'm sorry, I could go on and on.
Do you get many visitors?
We have a few regulars. I want to give a shout out to his friend James, who comes regularly. Carl and Martha and Gary and Avi. Like these are like our adopted, like our family. Luke and Kylie and my mom who comes regular. And his kids who come sometimes who are also have their own, his daughter recently lost her husband to cancer. Another son has a teen who he requires a lot of extra attention. And so there's even caregiving. And I acknowledge in reading this book, I realized that sometimes us caregivers also get focused so much on our own. But I think if we could share more with each other what we're going through, even family members, so that I think one thing I struggle with, and I'm trying to remember if I heard this in your book, Laura, is resentment sometimes.
Oh, yes. I just want to validate, if I may, a lot of the things that you're saying about the emotional toll, the exhaustion, the isolation. So many people I spoke with talked about never hearing from friends again, people just disappearing because they're uncomfortable with disability or impairment, which just goes to show how invisible it is. And that's what maintains people's discomfort, is that it's not something we talk about or are exposed to enough. And so we just need to be ourselves, be together, talk about what our struggles are so that we can normalize this, so that people don't have to feel uncomfortable and run away. And I also think that a lot of people who are going through this as spousal caregivers don't have people that they're talking to about it, precisely because, you know, these people fall away. And so I will just sort of plug the organization, the Well Spouse Association, which is a national organization that supports spousal caregivers. And one of the things that was really important for me was to be able to have a place where I could talk about being mad or being resentful, because there's such an expectation that you're not supposed to feel that way, that you're supposed to. One of the things that I really try to drive home is that we expect, because somebody loves somebody, that that person can take it all and they can never run out of energy. They can never run out of patience. And this idea of ever giving without getting support. And so one of the things that then happens is we need other people where we can say, I'm really angry about this, or I'm really feeling resentful about this, and it be in a room of people that are like, me too, or it's okay to think that way, because so many people expect for love to be this endless fuel. And unfortunately, it is not, because it doesn't provide the material care and assistance that we need in order to live, you know, and thrive, live without being in sleep deprivation, live with, I mean, think about disabled people and our ill partners whose entire dignity is dependent on one person, that one person being willing to stay. And that is not fair to anybody. And disabled people deserve more than that as well.
Yeah. And that organization, if you're interested, it's the Well Spouse Association, wellspouse.org. We're almost out of time, but Amy, are you finding many resources and support in the Bay Area?
You know, Bay Area based, no. There was just that one support group. There used to be something amazing called the Alzheimer's Services of the East Bay. There used to be a day center where I brought my grandpa when I was working full time, and it was so amazing. There were activities. Many of the people who went there, they thought they worked there, you know. So they made it feel like it was a place with dignity. There are almost no day centers for respite. The closest one, the only one in the East Bay that I know of, is in Orinda, and it's open 4 hours a day in the middle of the day. And it's a very white, upper-class community. He would not feel comfortable there anyway. So it's really, as a support, I am a regular caller of the Alzheimer's Association 24/7 hotline. They're my hotline, and I'm starting to open up more to people my own age, because I feel that there's more understanding, and I will randomly sometimes meet somebody who's also a caregiver or recently lost their person 8 years ago. Somebody who's now my go-to personal hotline, you know, a woman who I met when I opened up on a walk. And I think I just wanted to touch back to one thing, Laura, that you talk a lot about, which is the, you know, ableism, which I also have a, you know, this has been a part of my life too. And I think people are afraid of being around people with disabilities and dementia because they're afraid of it happening to them. And especially with dementia, this is going to happen to so many of us. I know that I'm at high risk, and I think that people don't want to see it because they imagine it being them.
And Amy, before we end, what would help you? What kind of resources would you like to see?
I think one of the things is I would love for caregiving to be destigmatized. There's a reason I'm only using my first name. Because I am judicious about who I want to share this with. I think there really needs to be, I think, a model that is similar to the support that goes to parents, which is also sorely inadequate, you know, like incredibly inadequate, but respite availability for people, for it to be more affordable, for there not to be, as Laura writes in her book, this like threshold that if you make $1 over a certain threshold, you do not qualify for any public assistance, right, with caregiving, for caregivers to be better compensated, just, you know, reorganize our society. You know, it's pretty simple.
Right.
It's just so much. But I think really for family and friends, here's the thing. It's also beautiful. There's also a lot of beauty in it. With dementia and the confusion and then going in and out of different realities and thinking he's on his way to school and, you know, like wow, imagining he's back in grammar school, that can be fun. So when you're dealing with somebody with dementia, if you can stay in a positive mode and play make-believe like when you were a kid and you would play make-up realities and do make-believe, it can be such a beautiful experience. And that's what many of his friends do with him.
Well, Amy, I just want to thank you so much.